And now, Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Bill
Lair. Hi, everyone. It's Dean Haglund from the Office of Irrational Exuberance here in the heart of the historic core of downtown Los Angeles in the middle of the Art Deco wonder that is the Eastern Columbia Building. This is your Chilpack Hollywood Hour, and I'm here with your co-host, as always, Mr. Ocho Cinco, Nuffity Nuff, the Sheriff. Phil Ernestles, gentlemen.
Thank you, Dean Haglund. You know, it's the day after Super Bowl Sunday.
Yes.
And I just read an interesting fact that something every year annually between 6 and 10% of the American workforce calls in sick on Super Bowl Monday.
Really?
Yeah. Which, and by the way, we both sound sort of like guys who wish they could.
I was really out partying in a storm up.
How was that? You were at our friend Ethan Dettenmayer's show. Combat Radio had a big Super Bowl party for charity.
For charity, yeah. There was an auction going on. Of course, Doug Jones was there, the Silver Surfer from the Fantastic Four series. And Alien.
I enjoy him as Abe from...
Yes, from Hellboy.
Hellboy movies, yeah.
Yes. He was there with the autographs. And Mark Ryan, of course.
He's a super nice guy, isn't he?
Oh, super nice guy. We should have him on the show.
We should work with him on something, too, I think, because he's just such a nice
He can
nice
fit
guy.
The outfit. He works... he just did Neighborhood Watch with Ben Stiller. He was in an Alien outfit.
He can fit the outfit.
He can fit the
outfit. Our outfit that we have in Ixnay on the other, you promised you wouldn't. What?
What? Every guest has to wear that outfit.
So that was fun for you then?
It was very fun. And then, of course, the Doors and the Frank Zappa Band mashup played. And I think I photobombed a picture with Dana Carvey. Walking in, a guy just posed, and then I sort of stuck my head in. And then he walked in, and then we all went, I think that was Dana Carvey just walked into that event completely unannounced. Maybe he's a big Doors Zappa fan. I'm not sure.
He loves the San Diego Cheerleaders. We know this.
Yeah, yes. Well, they were there. So perhaps he just showed up for that. I have no idea.
Did the double-signed copy of The Truth Is Out There go over like gangbusters?
Gangbusters. Well, we didn't stay all the way to the end for the auction. We had to, of course, drive back to Los Angeles. So
probably a best, wise decision.
Podcast. I'm, committed to making this podcast as best as I can make it. So that means going to bed early and forfeiting the silent auction.
I came back from San Diego for this podcast.
See
right
that?
Now. Just literally came in with my luggage.
I saw that. What was happening in San Diego?
I went to a Super Bowl party down there. A very dear old friend who you might remember. His name, Jeff Allen, he professionally goes by the name Yogi Allen.
Yogi Allen.
He's one of these guys that I love in the film business like us. He's sort of a do-it-yourself kind of jack-of-all-trades kind of guy. He was key grip officially on Spectres. But one of these guys who, when you get him, you're getting so many crew members in one. Gaffer, key grip. I mean, he's MacGyver.
he's the closest MacGyver.
And he was great because, as you know, we had so many really talented and enthusiastic kids. Fresh out of film school,
yes.
And where this was the first feature they'd worked on. Mm. And he was fantastic because he would put them through their paces when he would notice that someone seemed not to have anything to do. He would not let them stay idle, so he would give them a very serious assignment that was actually meaningless. And, in fact, truly meaningless. But like our friend Charles Kineo, who I've kept in contact with, who's a talented filmmaker and director of commercials, and who helped me on the short film Appearances. I went to his 30th birthday party not too long ago, and I mentioned that I was going to be seeing Yogi at his Super Bowl party, and he immediately shared this story about the day Yogi looked at him and said, I need a cube, and I need it made from 4C stands. And Charles had to say, okay, right away, sir, not knowing what any of that meant. And, of course, Yogi not needing those things.
Right, I didn't need that.
Which I love. Yeah. But anyway, so we've stayed in touch, and this was the first time I'd seen him since then. And down to his Super Bowl party, and it's really sweet how much of his memorabilia from his years in the industry is dedicated toward Spectres, because it's the favorite job he's ever done. He just had so much fun on that.
It's a fun shoot.
In terms of he really enjoyed the story of it, and he enjoyed the actors and just the spirit and the camaraderie of the whole thing, and also I think not the least of which was the fact that he got the chance both to solve problems that weren't quote-unquote the domain of the key grip,
right?
Which is the fun of doing an independent film, where things are it's everybody pitch in where you can,
right?
It's and nuts. Good ideas are just good ideas.
Yeah,
it doesn't matter what department they come from. And then the other thing is he got to teach, because there were so many impressionable young people, maybe too impressionable if he's giving them assignments like, give me a cube at a 4C stance.
I wouldn't even know how to do that.
Not your department. Right. You're above the line.
I'm above the line.
So anyway, so I went there, and he's involved in a theater company, doing the lighting for a theater company. We saw closing day performance, because you know I do one live event each week. Next week's will be the one that I saw yesterday. You know, I'll talk about it on next week's show.
There you go.
But so that was another part of it. But it was really interesting, because I had just read, I think, first thing in the morning, about this helicopter crash in Australia that killed writer producer Andrew White and cinematographer Mike Degree. Mm-hmm. Andrew Wright's White, was kind of known as James Cameron's right-hand man in Australia.
Ah, right.
Wrote and produced the big hit Sanctum, the 3D movie from last year.
Oh, yeah.
About cavern diving, and it was based on his own near-death experience doing underwater cavern.
Cave diving.
And I had just read about this, and when I heard about this, these two men in the process of pursuing their careers, their filmmaking activities, you know, they die in this helicopter crash. It always reminds me of when my friend Neil Fredericks, the DP of Blair Witch Project,
right,
who went on to be a cinematographer and producer of so many films. He died while shooting a film in a plane crash. I forget the name of the film now. Oh. The director, this was when we were situated over in the Cinema Arts offices doing this podcast, and it was a very interesting experience, because it was the first time in my life I'd ever had this experience where I was going through, you know, my appointments for the day, and I had a lunch meeting set up and realized, oh, that meeting's not happening because the person I'm meeting with is dead. And that's the first time I've ever had that experience. It was such an interesting. But he died in this plane crash. The director survived, and they all survived the crash, but they crashed into the water, and Neil drowned because of all the gear that was strapped to him. But what was fast? So I kind of thought, oh right, well I guess, you know, I'll be bringing up Neil on Monday's show, and this was what was in my mind when I walked into Yogi's Super Bowl party, and Yogi's built this amazing nightclub in his backyard. In 3 weeks, he built an entire structure with a bar and widescreen TVs, and it's this great place.
Wow.
But one of the first framed photos in his memorabilia I saw was Yogi posing with Neil Fredericks right after Neil Fredericks had strapped himself into that plane.
What? Yogi was on that plane?
He was on that shoot.
Ah.
The key grip didn't go up in the plane. It was just, I think, the pilot, the director, and the DP. Maybe there was an assistant camera. I'm not sure, but...
So they were filming aerial shots.
And then the plane went down. But so there's a photo of it right before that plane went up.
Wow.
And that was kind of powerful to see. And, you know, and I always think about this, because we've talked before about how when... soldiers die, or policemen, or firemen, or in these kind of ways, so many people will console themselves with, at least they died for what they believed in,
right?
And as we are fond of discussing, everybody dies for what they believe in,
right?
You know, if you want to know what someone believed in, look at how they die. You know, I believed I needed those three martinis every night right. when I got home from work, and lo and behold, my liver is what killed me.
Right? I believe, my cigarettes relax me, therefore.
And so really the greater thing, I think, would maybe be to honor people by saying, you know, that was someone who really lived for what they believed in.
Right.
And sometimes the way someone dies reflects that they actually lived what they believed in.
Yeah.
And certainly that was true with Neil Fredericks, and I would say with these people as well. And, you know, we're all going to die, and you never know when it's going to come. And why not live for what you believe in?
Why not? Live every moment like you believe in something. But no,
yeah, fake it until you can make it, actually. That's, right, that's not a bad... right. And you know, it's been a few weeks since we've had the chance to open the celebrity deaths file.
Celebrity deaths.
Here on Your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. And we may be spending much of today's show doing just that.
Really?
So why don't we open the old celebrity deaths?
Celebrity deaths.
Did you know that, did you hear this? This
no.
was yesterday. Yeah, how do you know? Yeah, I haven't even said it yet.
No, I don't know.
George Romero's patient zero, as he's fondly remembered, died.
George Romero's patient zero.
Patient zero. Bill Hinesman, the first ever zombie.
The first ever.
From the original Night of the Living Dead.
That guy?
He is now indeed dead, and I hope they are keeping an eye on Bill Hinesman's corpse.
He doesn't come back. Wow. That's funny. I didn't know... there was a patient zero of the zombie movement. I guess that technically...
There's the first one, yeah.
There's the first zombie. That's quite an honor, isn't it?
It is. And so that's why I think he's, you know, certainly we should remember him and honor
him. Let's remember.
And apparently he always had a real kick about that. Because remember, that was an independent film with a lot of mostly unprofessionals, non-professionals.
Shot over a series of weekends.
Pittsburgh, I
believe. In Pittsburgh, yeah. That's unbelievable.
And so it was always a big kick to him, and he would tell his grandkids, you know, yeah, I'm kind of famous. You know, and he would never really let on why or whatever. So.
That's hilarious. Wow. But there goes a zombie march and think of him.
We really, yeah, I mean, I would imagine that, you know.
There would be an honorary zombie march.
If not Comic-Con, certainly at Dragon Con.
Certainly at Dragon Con, they would do that.
They'll have tributes to Bill Hinesman.
Yeah.
Patricia Disney died.
Disney.
And it feels like not that long ago that we remembered, you know, her deceased husband, Roy Disney.
Roy.
Who, of course, for many years was the chairman of Disney Corporation.
Running it all, and saying what's-his-face was driving it into the ground.
And it feels like not that long ago we were remembering him, and as is so often the case, you know, when one spouse dies. So Patricia Disney...
Was she hands-on in the corporation?
Well, she had been struggling with Alzheimer's.
Ah, I see.
For quite some time. She was 77. And her interest and her passions really went towards philanthropy and has left behind quite a legacy of philanthropy in this
imagine
city.
It's sizable.
And so...
Hence Disney Hall, I would think, naming rights to our Frank Gehry Concert Hall.
Yeah, not the least of which, absolutely.
Yeah.
And the programs that Disney actually still continues to support there, at the not just the naming rights.
But, right. How about that?
So Patricia Disney, died this week. I'm going to go a little bit far afield in terms of how I define some celebrities this week.
Right.
Because
is a guy you heard of.
Well, no, I think that certainly one of the experiences of making The Truth Is Out There that was really kind of an eye-opener for me was that all the people that we interview in the film are really big deals. They are, the word that kind of came to mind was that they were insular celebrities.
Right.
You know, they're celebrities within their realm.
Their realm, their selected field of study or domain, as it were.
And, what you know, celebrity coming from the word celebrate it.
Celebrate it, exactly.
And so that kind of opens one's eyes to who celebrities ought to be. And you know, right. Certainly we can take a little time on this show.
I don't think that's ever been who's ought to be a celebrity. I mean, I think it's just sort of how media gloms on. I'm not sure.
But again, what is it? You know, that's just who the media says is a celebrity, whereas right. if you are in a particular world, this person's a big deal.
The big deal, you, right?
Yeah. And you see this at Dragon Con, right? Remember the story that I had about when I came back from getting my shoes fixed and I saw the longest line at Dragon Con? It doubled around that one hotel, the Sheraton, I guess, twice.
Yeah.
Wrapped around that block twice, and it was for a web series. The guys that created a web series, and that was the biggest line I saw, bigger than the line for Shatner.
Yeah,
you know,
isn't that funny? And you go, that's a big insular celebrity.
I think Lily is up for a lead in a spin-off web series from that web series, and I still don't know what that thing is.
My gosh.
And speaking of Truth Is Out There, today she's auditioning for that play where she runs off with a conspiracy theory.
Oh, yes.
And the scene she's auditioning for today is where she explains what really happened to Building 7. So she's quite prepared.
Quite prepared.
You're welcome, I said to her, for the preparation. Anyway, Eiko, E-I-K-O, I hate that I'm going to butcher this name, Eiko Ishioka,
mm-hmm.
A designer,
Yes.
Who brought an eerie, sensual surrealism to both film and theater and to album covers, to the Tokyo Olympics, to Cirque du Soleil.
Oh, yeah.
And in the process of her career, won an Oscar, a Grammy, and a string of other honors.
She designed. She got album design then for a Grammy.
And so I mean, so she should be remembered in a show called Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Absolutely,
I think, right? Because her contributions were profound.
Yeah.
She died of at 73 from pancreatic cancer in Tokyo.
Mm-hmm.
She trained as a graphic designer and was for decades considered the foremost art director in Japan.
Wow!
And later came to be known as one of the foremost in the world. In part through her collaborations with filmmakers like Francis Ford Coppola.
Oh, yeah.
For whom she designed the Oscar-winning costumes for Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Oh, those were outfits.
And she teamed with the director Tarsem Singh on four films, including The Cell.
Oh, yeah.
You know, with really J-Lo. And, yeah. You know, and I don't see those films because largely... the costumes creep me out so much. I'm serious. Of all the things people talk about, the visuals and that, it's the costumes that scare me.
Really, wardrobe scares you. Yeah, this is why you dress in a subtle black and gray motif. Any colors or anything like that, just send you running from the room.
I was, as I often am, I was extraordinarily well-dressed yesterday. And although I am certainly financially, I could not be more a member of the 99.
Uh-huh.
When it comes to fashion sense, I'm definitely in the 1%.
Well, yeah, it's good to dress as an elitist and be part of the 99%.
It should absolutely. I agree. That was always the thing.
Yes.
I mean, why I so often wear suits. It's great. You can sneak up sideways on so many people. You got the money people, you got the main people saying, "Oh, okay, he's one of us. We can talk to him. We can trust him."
Right.
You know? But then it's always cool when you know the hipsters or the punks or the punkers or whatever it is, you know, they think, oh, well, this guy, he's a suit. And then they hear what I'm talking about. And it's like, whoa.
Jazz cat. Totally.
Zalman King. Died appropriately enough at age 69.
What?
Because this is the man who wrote and produced 9½ Weeks.
Wow.
Who created... Red Shoes Diaries.
Oh.
David Duchovny's first starring role on television, right?
The first and last time we saw his ass.
Following his few episode run on Twin Peaks, but this was his first regular gig on TV.
That's right.
He started as an actor.
Mm-hmm.
But after writing and producing 9½ Weeks, ventured into directing a series of theatrically released erotic films, including...
softcore, one would say.
Two Moon Junction and Wild Orchid are probably the two most famous of them.
Right.
So Zalman King again, appropriately dead at 69.
That's horrible. And yet hilarious.
Dead at 57, and the impact that this guy had made me double check that this was how young he really was.
Well, yeah, 57 is pretty
Bingham
young.
Bingham Ray died at 57. He was rushed to a Salt Lake City hospital on his way to Sundance. He had just taken over as executive director of the San Francisco Film Society in November. This man, his legacy is so cool because... again, kind of like us, he comes at this business from so many different backgrounds and perspectives. He started as the manager and booker of Bleecker Street Cinema in the early 1980s.
My God.
That's how he got his start in show business. And as a manager and booker at a festival, theater,
right.
Left his mark on independent film scene by bringing such films as Mike Leigh's Secret and Lies and Lars von Trier's Breaking the Waves to American audiences.
Oh, wow.
Those were the first bookings those films
ever had at the Bleecker Street. I remember that theater.
In 91, he co-founded October Films, which was for a short time an Oscar-nominated which was bought... by USA Networks in 1999.
Is that what happened?
Huh. And in 2001, I mean, think about this. In 20 years, as a manager of a theater, 20 years later, he's named president of United Artists. Of course, which was always historically the most independent of the studios.
Distributors, yeah.
And during his tenure He released the Oscar-winning foreign language film No Man's Land.
Oh, yeah.
And the Oscar-winning documentary Bowling for Columbine.
Look at that.
So quite, again, a legacy in a variety of different ways.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's sort of amazing to think
that he was only 57.
57, which means that when he was the manager and the booker, he was in his mid-20s.
Which is in time when you would love film and you would be taking risks on independent things.
And again, a guy... I didn't mean this as a segue, but rushed to a hospital in Salt Lake City on his way to Sundance. Again, a guy whose death showed that he lived what he believed in.
Look at that.
Which was the importance of independent film.
See? Love that. How inspiring.
The bodies are piling up.
Gee whiz.
Here.
Has this all happened on this weekend, or is this
Been over the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, right?
But, you know, it had been very quiet.
Right.
The and death then, biz had been very quiet for a while.
Is this the solar
the
flares?
Holidays.
What,
I don't know.
What do you count for this?
I'm going to say the name, and you are going to tell me if you know. This is 85-year-old Dick Tufeld died.
Dick Tufeld.
He was an announcer and a narrator, and he's best known as?
The voice of ABC's Wide World of Sports.
No.
Oh.
I thought you were going to get it.
I almost had it. I know this
There's
name.
A B in it. The voice of...
BMB. I don't know.
The voice of Robot B9 on the TV series Lost in Space.
Lost in Space. That's
we
right.
We have all imitated him at one time or
Danger
another.
Danger Will Robinson.
Yes, we have.
Yes, we have. Wow. That's amazing. I actually knew his nephew lived across the street from me for the longest time. And
that is your brush with greatness.
That's my brush with greatness. Robbie the robot.
My brush with greatness on this show is that I once turned around in the following man's driveway high atop the city. I pulled a very unwieldy turnaround maneuver in my car.
3-point.
While this man wondered what the hell I was doing as I shouted, "You're Don Cornelius." And for years, I would tell people this, and they would say, "From Planet of the Apes?
Planet of the Apes?
No, not Cornelius from Planet of the Apes.
Oh.
Don Cornelius, the creator of the longest-running syndicated show in history, Soul Train.
Oh, yes, right.
And, of course, the host of it. He created it in 71.
Wow.
He hosted it until 93. And then at that point... he let young hosts take over, and he mentored them.
Right.
And it continued to run until 2006. It's kind of hard to remember this, but in a world pre-MTV, Soul Train was really important. I mean, you had American Bandstand, you had other things, but you had no show dedicated to
soul music,
to the African-American experience in music. That was bringing it to wide audience attention.
Everybody watched that thing.
And really, even after MTV, there were a lot of acts that couldn't break through on MTV. A lot of soul acts, continue to get television play and therefore get radio play when it really mattered still
back then.
Throughout the 80s because of Soul Train. So he was quite an influence, and there's... And everyone who worked for him, I mean, just spoke so highly of him. It feels like no one ever really got to know him so closely, which would probably explain why the fact that he died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound would come as so much of a surprise to everyone who didn't know.
Right.
But he did certainly have kind of this paternal or kind of uncle sort of
distance
from many of the people who worked
My
for him.
Question about you turning around in his driveway, did he actually step out to see you turn around, or was he just sitting on the porch and you turned around and went, "Hey?"
He was in his yard. I don't know.
He was in his yard and just staring at you going, why is this well-dressed weird man turning around in my driveway?
He's part of the 1%.
He's part of the 1%. And then you rolled
This was down. When I was location scouting for the Party Crashers.
I see. So therefore, then, you recognized him, and you rolled down your window to yell, "Hey, you're that guy that you know who you are."
Yeah.
Right?
Well, thanks for making me feel like a jackass. Yeah, you're right. He probably knew.
That's right.
He probably knew he was Don Cornelius.
But
it was a huge deal. I mean, that's... I don't get starstruck very often, but Don Cornelius, I mean, as a kid... look, Don Cornelius and Captain Kirk were probably the two coolest human beings at that point for me. So
wow, that is a sad childhood, I guess.
I don't know. At least I wasn't distracted by Paul Williams. All right.
Are we hacking on my favorite Phantom of the Paradise?
Kind of.
What?
I am going to do a Don Cornelius callback and tribute to close the show.
Wow.
So look forward to that.
I will look forward to that. Let's stay tuned for that.
Nicol Williamson. I often hear his name mispronounced, but I learned very early on how to pronounce his name. Nicol
Williamson.
Nicol.
Oh, Nicol. Nicol's the problem.
Because
as opposed to
in the opening credits of The Cheap Detective, finds a nickel on the ground, picks it up, and the actor's name appears in the opening credits, Nicol Williamson.
Mr. 5 Cents. Yes.
Nicol Williamson will probably always be best remembered by film audiences as playing Merlin in John Borman's 1981 Excalibur.
Right. I might remember that.
This guy, though, hailed from Scotland, Scottish actor, multi-Tony winning legend on stage, who was actually frequently compared to Marlon Brando in terms of his skill. I mean, he was that great and legendary a stage actor, and that was really his love. He had quite a successful film career in the 1970s, played Little John in Robin and Marian, Richard Lester's...
Oh, yeah, thing with Sean Connery.
Reimagined Robin Hood, and a very underappreciated and overlooked film. I mean, yeah. Connery and Audrey Hepburn and Robert Shaw. Audrey Hepburn played Maid Marian.
Not Catherine Hepburn.
No, not Catherine
I'm thinking
Hepburn.
Of Lion in the Winter.
You're
then.
Thinking of Lion in the Winter, which had nothing to do with Nicol Williamson.
No, it didn't.
And as he rolls over in his grave, played Sherlock Holmes in one of my favorite films of the 70s from Nicholas Meyer's award-winning book and Oscar-nominated screenplay, The 7% Solution.
One of the
book and film that really kind of opened the door for all these alternative universe
reinterpretation
stories.
Yes, absolutely.
And
fantastic.
He was Holmes in that.
Isn't that something?
Extraordinary.
I didn't know that.
And then again, as I mentioned, played Colonel Schlissel in The Cheap Detective. And for people who don't remember, Cheap Detective was a follow-up by the writer, director, and star of Murder by Death.
Right.
And Neil Simon wrote it, and it imagined that the character Bogart played in Casablanca and in Maltese Falcon were in fact the same man, just operating under different names. And it shows those films from the perspective of the stories weaving together.
Yeah, amazing. Actually, it's kind of funny.
And great cast and great performances.
All-star cast. All-star cast things of the 70s.
Remember and Nicol Williamson really gets his fair share of laughs.
Fantastic.
Finally, we lost an indelible actor. His likes will never be seen again. And one of my personal favorites, and also a man that once paid me quite a lovely compliment.
Really?
He said to me, "You know how to write one hell of a letter, kid." Because I tried to get him interested in doing a film that I was trying to get off the ground at a time when I knew he was taking an interest in independent film again. But he was taking an interest in independent film from the A-list independent directors of the world.
I
had made one unreleased indie film. But the fact that he called me to let me know that he appreciated the letter that I sent him was
nice.
Kind of the coolest.
Who are we talking about?
And this is Ben Gazzara.
Ben Gazzara died. I didn't know that.
At 81, it kind of killed me to read all the tweets, even from my dear friend Chris Jacobs of Entertainment Tonight, saying you'll always be remembered as the pornographer in The Big Lebowski. He's great in it, and he's really, but this guy's career, screen acting, I wrote this in the letter to him, and I meant this, screen acting does not get any better then his lead performances in John Cassavetes' Killing of a Chinese Bookie in 1976, and Peter Bogdanovich's Saint Jack, 1979. That is overlooked, and you would love it. It's so great. It's about a con artist in Singapore. And it also starred Denholm Elliott in a role that really kind of raised his profile, you know, which led to not only getting cast in movies like Raiders of the Lost Ark and Trading Places, but the E.M. Forster adaptations that Merchant Ivory did.
Yeah, right, later on.
And in a wonderful supporting role, a really good performance by George Lazenby 10 years after he'd been fired as James Bond.
Wow.
And it kind of makes you realize he did end up becoming a good actor.
Yeah.
You know, when he first played Bond, he wasn't an actor, and he did become really good. He did commit himself to learning the craft.
What was the TV series that Ben Gazzara did?
Yes. In the 1960s.
Remember that opening? So exciting.
I have it written down. Is it Run for Your Life?
Yeah.
Yeah, Run for Your Life.
Run for Your Life.
Big hit series.
Totally awesome. I loved that as a kid.
He had been, you know, an actor studio member who again made his name on Broadway stage, playing roles, creating roles that would be played in the movies by the likes of Paul Newman.
Right.
His real big breakthrough for me was his second film, Anatomy of a Murder,
yes,
where he stars opposite Jimmy Stewart and George C. Scott. Great movie.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, like you said, in the 1960s, became a huge TV star. And then in the 1970s, thanks to his buddy John Cassavetes, really established a legacy for himself in cinema, starring in Cassavetes' Husbands, opening night, and again, Killing of a Chinese Bookie.
Yeah.
And as a result of that, he became an idol for generations of indie filmmakers.
Of course.
The Coens, who we mentioned.
Right.
David Mamet, he stars in David Mamet's Spanish Prisoner with Campbell Scott and Steve Martin.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Vincent Gallo's Buffalo 66.
That's right. I forgot he was in that.
He's so good. Spike Lee's Summer of Sam. These are all in the late 90s.
That's amazing.
Todd Solondz's Happiness and Lars von Trier's Dogville.
Wow.
I mean,
like how
that
more
range of actors.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, a range of directors and that range of films, and they all, we got to get Ben Gazzara. Because there was just a certain kind of vulnerable masculinity that he embodied that nobody else
does.
Certainly, yeah, I mean.
Not when you either get too macho or too whimpery, but there was.
The closest I could compare him to would be Robert Forster. But Robert Forster is not the powerhouse actor that Ben Gazzara was.
Yeah, that's true.
Not riveting in the same way with the same charisma. Again, as the name of the film that made Robert Forster a star would indicate, Robert Forster is medium cool, whereas Ben Gazzara was really hot and cool. anyway, Ben Gazzara dead at 81.
There you go, 81.
We have so many other things to.
I know what is going on.
Talk about you
We're
know.
Not gonna get us all in one show.
What are you reading?
What am I reading? Let's see. New on the shelf. I just got the book that I would run away to my book table to show you, but it's about American writers who made themselves famous in France, who left America to become famous in Paris.
Expats. Such as Mr. Fitzgerald.
Mr. Fitzgerald, Wendell Oliver Holmes, the other person that...
The other guy.
The other guy. Well, Chapter 3.
Wasn't Hemingway also? I mean...
Hemingway was already kind of famous, but but he was already in Europe.
He was just holding court in Europe as the famous writer.
Well, he was a war correspondent during the Spanish Civil War, and then all of that writing. So he's holding court and hanging around Europe after the war, and then came back and hung out in Key West.
Well, this is fascinating, and great minds think alike. I finished Winter's Tale by Mark Helprin.
Oh, yes.
673-page opus, which I can now actually say you were right. It's magical realism. At that time, I didn't know where I was in the book. I didn't know, but it really does become magical realism. And I'm so glad that I did read it and finish it. It's an amazing book. It's fantastic. And it's going to be the directorial debut of Oscar-winning screenwriter Akiva Goldsman, who's been trying to get it made for almost 20 years. The book was published in 83, and now that Russell Crowe and Will Smith have signed on,
holy smokes,
he called in favors from them to play supporting parts so that he could get the film bankrolled.
Holy
and,
crap.
So I'm glad I read it before Akiva Goldsman has the chance to destroy it. So,
I saw that coming.
Speaking of film versions that are going to destroy legendary works, Baz Luhrmann has a 3D version starring Leonardo DiCaprio of The Great Gatsby coming out at Christmas. Everyone's really looking forward to it.
Wait a sec. 3D Great Gatsby?
And so I thought it's about time I revisit The Great Gatsby. I haven't read it since high school.
Yes.
So I am reading F. Scott Fitzgerald's Great Gatsby.
I might read The Last Tycoon just so that we can compare notes on Fitzgerald.
That was a good movie, though. Last Tycoon made a good movie. But again, like we say, sometimes the not weak books, but the flawed books make better movies.
Right. Because
it was unfinished.
It was unfinished, right? The last thing he was working on. But... I don't know. I don't understand why I would want a 3D Great Gatsby, unless the wild Hollywood parties of the 20s in 3D. I mean, to see him dance in a fountain. I don't know.
I don't know.
That doesn't make any sense.
It's Baz Luhrmann. He's a genius, you know.
The word genius is often thrown around easily these days.
Yes.
I'll just leave it at that.
Only by geniuses. Because it takes one to know one.
The Chill Pack Hollywood live event of the week.
I saw a live event this week.
Yeah, what'd you see?
I saw, I had never seen this play, Tony-winning play by Yasmina Riza, who wrote, of course, Carnage.
Yes.
I'd never seen her Tony-winning play, Art.
Art.
And I saw a production of it at the Pasadena Playhouse.
Yeah, what'd you think?
Starring Bradley Whitford, so famous from West Wing.
Yes.
Academy Award nominee Michael O'Keefe, who got his nomination for Great Santini, was so good in the TV series Roseanne, and of course will always be Danny from Caddyshack.
And downtown resident.
And Roger Bart, a Broadway performer extraordinaire, Roger Bart, who... for me, really, first came to prominence when he, I really took notice of him when he replaced Nathan Lane in The Producers.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And was better.
And was better.
For me, anyway.
For you, right.
And it's a wonderful text. It's those actors are all good, and it's a delightful play. And I'm not sure it all comes together in the Pasadena Playhouse production of it. Some of the staging is rather awkward. And... some of the casting, they'll hit comedic moments brilliantly, and then I don't buy the emotional moments.
I see, right.
And one wonders, you know, when you're clearly, it's going to be names, we're going to get names and put in this, and it's you're not auditioning maybe the same way that you would for chemistry.
You're right.
I don't know how theater works in theater casting like that, especially at that level.
Yeah, where it's big money and you need...
yeah,
marketing, marquee value.
Yeah,
that's tough. I'm sorry, but did they actually? You know, I think I read about a production where they didn't actually show the art everyone was talking about.
That's a really interesting idea, and I wish I hadn't seen the art.
Right, because it actually diminishes the audience's imagination to imagine.
Yeah.
Because the word descriptions, so you actually
the word descriptions, and it also would have made for more interesting staging.
Well, then perhaps there was the flaw that I just guessed out
because
of the top
you would
of my
have
head.
Because you would have had to put it in places that would suddenly block perspectives, and you'd have to it would force you into a different.
Well, in fact, that's what they did. The fourth wall in the stage was the wall that all the art hung on, and then they were all looking.
I love that.
Right, and then they were all addressing it.
I love that because those same set was used as three different homes.
Right,
which is probably. I don't know. I haven't seen any other productions, and that was kind of an interesting idea. How the only thing that changed was the piece of art.
Right.
Everything else was the same between these people. And at the same time, that's an interesting idea. But it didn't add anything.
Right.
You know, and something like that is really a kind of a fresh perspective change and would make the attention, even if you use the same set for everyone's home, it would change the character's perspective.
It's an acting exercise.
So much.
Yes, it's like
that. You would look at the set in a totally different
way. Right. It becomes the work of the actor to embody each place as a different location, even though it's staged exactly the same.
Well, so there is your live event of the week.
Fantastic.
We have so much Hollywood development news.
Look at us go.
To discuss
things. Should we wait for Oh, no, that's
our... Of interest. 1 year after going commando, if you'll pardon the expression.
Hey, none of that.
Despite the foreign sales help he received from Lionsgate... No, he received domestic help from Lionsgate, foreign help from other companies. But Kevin Smith with Red State.
Oh, yes.
Sort of, kind of went commando on that.
On that. Kevin doing it himself, following his tweets.
He was back at Sundance signing an output distribution deal with Phase 4 for all his future productions.
All his future productions.
Yeah, or 12 or 13 productions or something.
Wow.
That's an interesting development.
That is interesting. Does that mean he doesn't have to do the heavy lifting himself anymore?
Maybe.
Phase 4 will now tweet for him.
You're so down on his tweet.
I am. 8,000 tweets per second for 5 minutes while Madonna was on stage last night at the halftime show. I didn't get one of them. Who am I following? Am I following everybody who's completely not in it? But can you imagine that? 5,000
I walked in at halftime. I didn't know she was the performer, and I walked in at halftime, and there she's performing, and I'm why are they showing a Super Bowl from 1985? What is happening? 1 year almost after the Blade Runner 2 rights were secured, and then Ridley Scott quite awesomely signed on to direct the follow-up to Blade Runner. And you know, how great, 30 years later, a failed movie is going to get a follow-up.
Yeah, fantastic.
Because it's just fantastic. And then a lot of rumors were, you know, would it be a sequel? Would it be a reboot? Is it in the same universe?
Right.
What will it be? But what became very clear was Harrison Ford will not be a part of this.
Right.
And that made sense for a variety of different reasons, not the least of which was Harrison Ford hates Blade Runner and hated working on Blade Runner and didn't enjoy working with Ridley Scott.
Right. And if we get aside that, the fact that he's supposed to be a replicant, he wouldn't age. He would be aged at that point, which then you'd have to...
Spoiler alert.
Oh, like who hasn't seen Blade Runner who listens to our show?
But who is in the process of signing on board the new Blade Runner? But Harrison Ford.
No.
Yes. Negotiations are underway for him to be in. And this was the first comment that I read was, how can Deckard be an old dude? This was the quote, exactly the thing. How can he be an old dude when he's a replicant?
Right.
And what I loved, though, was the follow-up to this, which was someone said, well, how do you know he's a replicant? That's subject to interpretation. Well, the obvious answer is this has to be a follow-up to Ridley Scott's version of the film,
right,
where it was clear he's a replicant, because otherwise, why would Ridley Scott come back?
Right.
Right? Ridley Scott's not coming back to do the bastardized version of it. But instead of explaining all that...
Yeah.
The guy who made the original post was awesome.
Yeah.
He wrote, how do I know that he's a replicant? A unicorn told me in a dream. Which is so cool.
So that is perfect.
So anyway, that's interesting. And why would Harrison Ford be changing his tune and wanting to do his... Because there are very few films that'll pay him his full freight anymore.
Absolutely.
And he's determined to get paid his full freight.
Well, and Calista Farquhar is an expensive date.
Oh, my God. What? I don't... How do you know that?
Why did I say that? That's rude.
A sci-fi film that I'm looking forward to.
Oh, sure,
maybe I shouldn't be. You can tell me that maybe I shouldn't be. I get the feeling you'll be skeptical about this.
Okay.
It's called Absolutely Anything. Sci-fi farce that is the re-teaming of all the living members of Monty Python, to be directed by Terry Jones and produced by Mike Medavoy. That's a lot of talent there. You're skeptical.
I'm skeptical. I'm sorry. You know, I recently wanted to introduce a couple of people to the wonders of Monty Python, and it did not hold up in terms of some of the comedic moments, sadly. You know, I saw a bad touring production of Spamalot, and it made me realize how very specific the talent was to the time and that sort of thing. And I fear that maybe it's not holding to the next generation.
I also wonder without Graham Chapman.
Yes.
Because he
was actually the good actor of the bunch.
He really was,
right?
He?
I mean, the other guys could write or have the odd bits, but it was Chapman who actually held the theatrical...
He had the gravitas.
The gravitas of like bringing an emotional story arc to everything. So, but man of... And who's directing, you said?
Terry Jones.
Terry Jones.
Who directed, of course...
Yeah, Jabberwocky and all the...
Holy Grail.
Yes, and yeah. Holy Grail, and I'm thinking Brazil.
You're thinking of Terry Gilliam.
I'm thinking Terry Gilliam.
Who
Terry
did Gilliam. The? Who directed the animation sequences of the Python
yes.
films.
Is yes. he involved?
I don't know, not yet. I don't think so. It will be a combination, though, of animation and live action.
Well, then maybe there's something.
Look, if anybody deserves a shot, why not them?
Why not them? Cleese is still hilarious
yeah.
and delightful. And then,
is Eric Idle still delightful?
Yeah, he's quirky.
Another science fiction film... that seems kind of interesting. It's a high-profile sci-fi indie film
Ooh.
Directed by Bong Joon-ho, whose Korean film The Host, you know, I'm a
yes,
big fan of.
That.
Remade as Cloverfield. Not a big fan
not
of
a
the
big
remake.
Fan.
But he's getting to do a big indie sci-fi in the English language. And our soon-to-be Oscar-winning Octavia Spencer from The Help just joined the cast that already included Chris Evans, Captain America, John Hurt.
Ah.
You get John Hurt in a sci-fi film, I'm
you know,
there.
You got Robert.
Tilda Swinton, who again, I've said that she kind of bugs me, but I'm a big fan of We Need to Talk About Kevin.
Yeah.
And Tilda Swinton, sci-fi. That's a good call.
That's a good call. That seems like she's from a foreign planet.
And they're already on board, and it also stars, and I'm going to attempt his name, the Korean gentleman who starred in The Host.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So I'm very excited about that.
That's exciting.
That's really cool. And that's I love sci-fi when they are international co-productions.
Right.
Those often have such a cool feel to them.
Right, a global aspect to it as opposed to...
What about...
No, I'm not even going to say names.
And how do I have on development news as two films I'm looking forward to? Two films with Tilda Swinton and John Hurt. They're both teaming up also in Jim Jarmusch's
Ooh.
New vampire film.
What?
Only Lovers Left Alive.
Wow. That seems dark.
And since I'm never going to get to see the finished version of Appearances, because one of the producers is dicking around so much because we made a good movie, and he's upset about changing the music. So he's just pissing all over everything and
wow.
everyone's hard work. Since we're never going to get to see that, I'll look forward to seeing Only Lovers Left Alive.
Oh, my God. Wow, that's a. I'm sorry to hear about Appearances. I was really looking forward to that.
It's so badass. It really is so bad. Look, I'm going to show the finished version at different places.
Yeah,
good you know? For you. And anyone who doesn't like it can go fuck themselves. It's a short film. I've lived too long to care.
We like to have old lawyers just clip this part and play it in court.
Again, another foreign language filmmaker whose next project I'm really looking forward to. Romanian Christian Mungiu, mm-hmm. who made the fantastic 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days,
yes,
has not made a film since then. Since that won the Palme d'Or in 2007,
wow!
And finally, going to make a follow up, and it's being produced by Wild Bunch, and it's set in an Orthodox convent in Romania. The story centers on a young woman's descent into madness, her subsequent exorcism, and the police investigation. All of that sparks.
Wow.
He hits topics hard.
Doesn't he? That's awesome.
Yeah, so I'm looking forward to that.
Okay.
We have a couple of TV development news things that I
really?
Think are interesting.
Okay.
You know.
I'm looking forward to interesting TV news.
Well, just, you know, I mentioned Appearances, which we did.
That wasn't going to be on TV.
My old friend Shawnee Smith, though, who was the star of my film The Party Crashers.
Yes.
She's just, and everyone loves her in the Saw movies.
Yes.
And she's just signed on to be one of the series leads in Charlie Sheen's FX comedy series Anger Management, playing his ex-wife.
Really?
So good for her.
Good for
she
her.
She was on Becker for a long time. She's got quite the... Even though she's probably her biggest gigs are always horror films, she's got such a wonderful comedic chops.
Calm chops. So, well, okay. Good for her.
And your former co-star Gillian Anderson returning
yes.
to television in a series.
Really?
On the BBC.
Called?
A 5-episode series, The Fall...
Oh.
Playing a police detective chasing a serial killer across Northern Ireland.
Wow. Good for her.
How's that going to interfere with the big X-Files 3 shoot?
Ixnay.
And of course, the biggest development news of the week is the approaching membership vote on the potential SAG after a merger. I was thinking we should ask Ari Gross, who's been on this show and who's been working so hard since becoming a SAG board member on trying to craft the language for a merger, and our old friend David Soboloff, who came on so many times to talk about SAG business.
And the animation arm, too, yeah.
Well, and remember, he even tried to run, I believe, for AFTRA.
Yeah.
Because, maybe we changed things from the inside of AFTRA.
Right.
Which was a very smart and ultimately misguided attempt on his part.
Yeah.
Fruitless, I guess, would be the way, because it made sense, which seemed to be sorely lacking in the political world of show business unions. But it might be interesting if I just wrote them and asked them to maybe just submit their basic thoughts about...
Right. If they can't make it to the show.
Well, I don't know if we want to dedicate a whole show to it.
Oh, just, yes. Just a brief overview of the fight ahead and the problems involved.
Well, I don't even know if it'll be a fight. I get the feeling it's a fait accompli.
I think so. You know, I was talking to Mark Ryan, the voice of Bumblebee from the Transformers, and he was saying that, you know, just dealing with Paramount on a hit Michael Bay movie and how it is now such narrow margins and that they trim and nickel and dime you to death, that a merger is the only way that you're going to survive in the next decade in the way business is done now. I mean, it's not even a contract. A signed contract means almost nothing in this business.
And if, you know, it's just, look, what are the terms and are they good? And is there the ability to finesse things that maybe aren't working well once the merger takes place? I mean, these are interesting questions. So so maybe they'll be giving us the benefit of their insight.
So you look forward to that.
Did you see anything? Have you, you know, added to that list of 15 films from 2011?
No. It's been, again, a busy week.
I finally caught The Puss in Boots, nominated for Best Animated Film.
Lighting design by our very own neighbor, Greg Lev.
Oh.
Yes.
It's delightful.
Is it?
It's delightful.
No, it's not.
A cat with a Spanish accent fighting battles. I'm there. I'm always there.
He's overweight, though, isn't he?
No, only in the one Shrek movie.
Oh, right.
No, this is when the legend was born.
Oh,
so
I see. He's quite dashing. Oh.
No, I loved it.
Really?
I wasn't really a fan of the Shrek movies too much. My favorite part was kind of Puss in Boots.
The donkey?
No. I saw Young Adult.
Ah.
From the director and writer of Juno.
Yes.
Writer Diablo Cody, director Jason Reitman, hot off Up in the Air.
Yes.
Not a bad movie, but a Diablo Cody movie, which means it never really delves.
Right.
Everything's pretty much at the surface. And the direction of that is everything sort of expected. And what was interesting, I mean, I loved certain touches about it. I loved... and also a movie with Charlize Theron, you understand why a movie star like Charlize Theron would want to play the part, but at the same time, when it isn't delving, the force of a movie star's personality tends to overwhelm these things, and if it had been an indie film, again, with an unknown, well, then it might become more interesting, the story. But I actually was sitting there thinking I had a perfect way to have not only salvaged, but really made masterpieces out of two flawed films from last year by simply switching their directors.
Oh.
If The Descendants had been directed by Jason Reitman with George Clooney in the lead.
Oh, yeah.
Because what kind of performance did he get out of using everything we love about Clooney in interesting ways in Up in the Air?
Because
I think that might be Clooney's best.
I
work
agree.
As an actor.
Yeah.
Boy, what might that have been like? And if Alexander Payne, who always finds the unexpected in scenes, had directed Young Adult, then suddenly becomes a female-driven version of Sideways, almost.
Wouldn't that be something?
So that was just what I was thinking during that.
Wow.
So.
See, that's the kind of producing skills they need out there.
I've started seeing 2012 films.
Yes.
I saw Contraband.
Oh, yeah. I heard that's good.
Which is not about a musical group that played for the Nicaraguan rebels, no. As it turns out. They're not a contraband.
That's so sad.
No, it's smuggling. Smuggling. It's all right. There's nothing wrong with the movie at all.
Action-packed, I hear.
And yet I'm not exactly clear on why we're supposed to care, ever, right. ever. And also, you know what I kind of find like distasteful is the effort that's made over and over again to make it clear, like, they're not going to smuggle drugs. They're not going to smuggle that. So that we know they're good people who right. are involved in an illegal thing. Because smuggling counterfeit money, smuggling rare art, these are victimless.
These are victimless. Right, rare art, you know, when you smuggle that, you're just trying to get art to more people.
But what I do love about, again, seeing films and why I see so many films and when I start asking questions, I have a sci-fi conspiracy thriller idea about counterfeit money that came to me like a laser blast
really?
During Contraband.
Wow. Are you going to pitch it on the air?
We'll discuss this.
No, let's
punch we'll discuss
it.
This later. Yeah, oh, okay. Doug Jones. There's a perfect role for him.
Doug Jones,
he fits the outfit. And I also saw The Gray.
Oh, yes. Wolves attacking Liam Neeson.
Liam Neeson Smithers. Kicks nature's ass would be the title of that on that poster if it right. was Truth in Advertising. This is, again, a very well done movie, especially the first hour is pretty extraordinary. It's already been announced that it'll be re-released theatrically in October
wow.
to push it for an Oscar. Our friend Luke Y. Thompson asked on a tweet, can we just give it Best Picture now?
The Gray?
But it's from Joe Carnahan, who made The A-Team. But he also made Narc, which was quite
kinda
a
good.
Great movie.
Yeah.
I'm uncomfortable with the demonization of wolves. And I know it sounds funny, but you know, you've got so many people who think it's still fun to hunt them.
Hunt them, shoot them down in Yellowstone Park. They have that big issue with the farmers and the reintroduction of the wolves that actually stabilized the entire ecosystem.
If the threat of the wolves had been truly a metaphor, then I'm with you.
Right.
And even if there had been confrontations, but when it all comes down to almost a haunted house, they're picking us off one by one, we need to start thinning the herd one by one, kind of. Yes, it deals with issues, and it deals with, it does delve, and it does go into some interesting material, but I am, like I said, uncomfortable with the demonization
well, then,
of the wolves.
It's off my list.
The Chill Pack Hollywood Lawsuit of the Week.
Finally, I would like to end with one lawsuit of the week, because this is so extraordinary. I'd been wondering when the Fox Rupert Murdoch phone hacking scandal would be utilized in this country as the basis for a lawsuit.
Uh-huh. And it's finally arrived.
Our loyal listener and friend Agent Summer called this to my attention. An article that was in Digital Spy who reported this. A man has filed a lawsuit against News Corp, insisting that the company tapped his phone and used his personal details in conversations not only for Donnie Darko, but for the X-Files and Burn Notice. So apparently this guy's life has been used as the basis for all these three. And from wiretapped
phone conversations.
I would imagine you would have to prove that your phone has been tapped and that they were the ones tapping it, wouldn't it?
Well, no, not necessarily, because
wouldn't you have to show a chain? Because all these things about stealing someone's life rights or stealing an idea or whatever, you have to prove access to that material.
Right.
Right? It doesn't matter that something might be incredibly similar. You have to prove that they actually knew about you and had access to it.
Yeah.
In some way.
Boy, that's going to be a tough case, but I'm going to follow that one.
Of course we will.
I think that maybe have that guy
the Donnie
show.
Darko wiretapping.
Donnie Darko, X-Files, Burn Notice. You see a through line through all of those shows that is clearly...
Do you?
No, you don't.
Oh my God, you had me very, very intrigued all of a sudden.
I was trying to think, what would the through line be, actually? How would that be all in one person?
You know, however people listen to their Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, be
there's
it
so many ways.
Jackalope Radio,
yes,
the Talk Superstation.
We love.
Or at chillpackhollywood.com.
Perhaps the easiest.
CHILLPAK Hollywood.com, where you can download and stream many episodes and even subscribe via iTunes and really simple syndication.
Yep.
No matter how you listen to the show, if you've come to the show somewhat recently and have never heard many of our back catalog shows that are still not available because it takes a long time to get these put back up.
Yep.
please note that there is a special bonus Chill Pack Hollywood Hour installment that we cut shortly after the fourth anniversary of the show.
That's right.
It's not necessarily a best of, but it's a pretty wonderful show, funny and inspiring, and has never before heard and unavailable in any other way material made specifically for that show. It's a fourth anniversary bonus installment of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, and it is available by writing us at chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com.
So easy.
And for $1.29.
That's all.
Like an iTunes download.
Look at that.
Not only do you get this otherwise unavailable show, but you help make sure that your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour will always be available and always be free.
Be free!
So write us if you would like that show.
Please do. Like us on Facebook, of course. We're at facebook.com/chillpackhollywood.
Follow us on Twitter.
Follow us on Twitter. I'm at D. Haglin.
I'm at Phil Larinus.
And
you can even be a friend on MySpace.
Yeah, we're still on MySpace.
We do a blog every week that hundreds of people read.
Hundreds.
Previewing the next week's show.
Yes.
And that's myspace.com/chillpackhollywood. The very first ever installment of the Chill Pack Hollywood Hour Movie Lover's Companion is available on our website, chillpackhollywood.com, looking at the most overlooked films of 2011.
Fantastic.
We added one to that list this week. And once a month, we'll do a Movie Lover's Companion article there on the website.
Fantastic. We give.
Some more. And as I promised, I leave you with a sign-off that is how Don Cornelius used to sign off every episode of Soul Train. I will change his name to our names. So we end with a tribute to Soul Train's late, great Don Cornelius by saying, as he would say, "And you can bet your last money, it's all going to be a stone gas, honey." We're Phil Larinus and Dean Haglund, and as always, in parting, we wish you love, peace, and soul.
Belated spoiler alert.